Today is June 12th, 1986. The following interview is with Sue Daoulas, D-A-O-U-L-A-S. Mrs. Daoulas is a member of the Drug Abuse Policy Office. The interview will take place in her office. Set this right between us and it'll pick up everything we say, I can assure you. All right, when did you join the White House staff, Sue? Approximately.
I was put on the payroll the 3rd of February 1981 and had done some volunteer work between the inauguration and paid employment. I had worked on the transition, the Reagan Bush transition headquarters, and came over here almost immediately after that on a volunteer basis.
How was it that you got connected with the Reagan Bush transition? Were you working in the campaign?
I had done some volunteer work on the campaign. Had volunteered in the 76 Reagan campaign and worked in politics all my life, starting with Goldwater in 64.
Are you from this area?
Mm-mm.
Where are you from?
Indiana. Moved out here in 1979 to marry my husband.
Got to get that in.
That's right. Want to make it clear I didn't move out here to work in the Carter administration. But had been in the Republican Party for a long time, and so Daryl Trent hired me on the transition, and I worked for Ed Harper on the transition and then came over here.
What did they tell you about what your responsibilities would be when you came over here, as you say? Did they tell you ahead of time that you were going to be in the Office of Policy, Drug Abuse Policy or Office of Policy Development?
Well, actually, I didn't start working for the Drug Abuse Policy Office until April of 82. When I first came over, Bob McCarthy, who was setting up the Library of Transition Materials, needed somebody to help him and somebody who'd worked with the documents before, and so that was me because that's what I did on transition. So he brought me over here and to help him set up the library and to kind of get magazine subscriptions in order, and I worked with Dick Williams on the budget. And so I was initially hired as Office of Policy Development, and when Bob McCarthy only stayed for a few months, and then my boss became Ron Francom. And I did, it was jack of all trades, master of none for Mr. Francom. Something I probably shouldn't admit, but he and me and several other people were responsible for starting the 208 restoration. And it was not near as expensive the way we started to do it. When NSC took over, it kind of got out of hand. But so I worked on that, which was interesting because we had to find out a lot of history about the building and about the room.
When you started on the restoration of that room 208, was it your intent and goal simply to renovate it to what its original state was?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It has changed since that point.
Dramatically.
Okay.
Yes. What we intended to do was basically we were just appalled that there was wall-to-wall carpet and 47 layers of paint over stenciled walls and gold leaf trim on the fireplace and, you know, cut through the floor and the air conditioner didn't work and it was just a lousy room. It had, when you walked in, it had grass cloth wallpaper. I mean, it was just a brown carpet, not even a nice color brown. You know, it was brown carpet. And we said, you know, look, this was the former Secretary of State's office, and it should look like the former Secretary of State. So when we first started the restoration, we wanted the carpet pulled and the floor brought back to life. And the table was in fine shape. The chairs were nice. You know, there were no problems with those. But, you know, remove the wallpaper and bring the stenciling back out and, you know, things like that. well, then it became, well, let's turn it into semi-conference room with some computer facilities. Well, for some computer facilities became a hall of computer facilities.
Okay. Enough said. How long did you stay on that project, by the way?
I guess it was about a year before we lost control of it. We, OPD, lost control of it. You know, we had, OPD had no business planning a secure conference room. You know, it's not our expertise. So, worked on that project for about a year, on and off, interspersed with other things. I was still helping Dick with the budget. And
now, when you talk about the budget, and
Office of Policy Development's
okay,
budget.
Okay. This wasn't revenue policy.
No.
This was
no.
OPD. All right.
Then in, let me see, April, March, early, late winter, early spring of 82, Marty Anderson left the White House. And when Marty Anderson left, who was head of OPD at the time, Ed Harper came in to take over. And there were a lot of reorganizations and reshuffling of OPD staff. So Mr. Frankham decided that he didn't really want to stay and went up to work in science and technology policy with Jay Keyworth. So my job was kind of disappearing and my boss had disappeared and Carlton didn't have a secretary or anybody in his office at the time. And so Dick Williams asked if I might want to work for Carlton Turner. And I said, but I don't want to be a secretary. And he said, I know that, but would you help us out? So then I went to work for Carlton and worked for him ever since, doing a variety of things. A
jack of all trades again?
Yeah, it started out that way. I started doing a lot of secretarial work because he didn't have anybody. Carlton had been here since July of 81 and had had two different gals in the office. One couldn't put phones on hold. Seriously. And the other was fresh out of college and had never worked in an office before, and to no fault of her own, you know, she couldn't time, she was a loyal Reaganite, and that was good. I mean, it served the purpose at the very beginning, but she couldn't type well, she had no idea of what a filing system should be like, so when I came in, there were literally four stacks of piles of papers as tall as my desk that needed to be filed. So, and I'm not, you know, I don't set up offices, that's not my expertise either, but I set one up kind of by guess and by gosh, and continued doing that kind of work, and long about August, I said, look, enough is enough, I have got to have some help, or I'm going to go crazy, and it's a short trip. So we hired a little gal who, you remember Jenny Nelson?
I remember that.
Okay, she came in, right out of college, young, but you know she did a lot of the answering the phones and that kind of thing, and that helped a lot. And that freed me up to do other things. The office staff was so small at the time. It was Carlton Turner and Dick Williams and Dan Leonard and myself, and that was basically it. So I had, everybody had to be involved in everything that the office did. Whether it was talking points for the president or the first lady or scheduling proposals or private sector initiatives, or it didn't matter what it was. It didn't matter if it was education and prevention or drug law enforcement or, you know, everybody had to be involved in everything because we had four people to do 10 people job. So I learned a lot very, very quickly. And Dick and Carlton have been super supportive of me all along. So as we hired new staff, we hired a communications person, and that helped me out a little bit. First John Keller and then Pat McKelvey. Because when they weren't there, I was having to do that too, and I don't like to talk to the press. Then we got on detail a writer, Sharon Lumpkins, who we've now hired back since they wouldn't detail her again. And so the office has grown, and as it's grown, my responsibilities have grown. And a year ago, a little over a year ago, I moved over to this office, and they promoted me to policy analyst. So that 3 years, 4 years later, I'm no longer a secretary. And I've continued to do the private sector stuff, a lot of the liaison work with private sector, because they've been very involved and very supportive of First Lady's program to a large degree, and just special initiatives in drug abuse education and prevention. Also worked with all the intelligence and international side of the drug business. So, spent a lot of time talking to intelligence community and State Department, Agency for International Development, OAS, and things like that. And then I also do a lot of the First Lady stuff, still, because I'm used to it.
I wasn't aware of all that, so it's very impressive. I don't know where to start to just kind of follow up on some of those questions. Is there any way you can break down the percentage of time that you spent working with the First Lady as opposed to the Intelligence International contacts, opposed to just private sector liaison work?
Well, it really varies. The private sector was very supportive, like Keebler Company and IBM, those kinds of companies have put out the comic books, the Teen Titans comic books. And Keebler has been so good that they developed a shopping mall program, and they got their little Ernie the Elf to go with them. And they take this little program around to the different shopping malls and tell kids about the dangers of drugs, and they've reprinted the comic book like 4 times and given us like 5 million copies of the comic book. It's just been outstanding. They also did a film for their I Believe in Me, which is the theme of their shopping mall program, but they did a film so that they can make it available to schools around the nation so that the young, they can reach more young people. It's good PR for them, but they've done it at no gain for monetarily. It may be a tax write-off, or it may be good PR, but for whatever reason, they've funded the comic books, they've developed these films, they're doing wonderful things. And
is there a copy of that film in your files, or somewhere
no.
in the Office of Drug Abuse Policy? Does the White House
They're
have a copy?
It. They're still taping it.
Okay.
It's that recent, the film is. We have copies of the comic book.
I thought that.
The film, actually, Mrs. Reagan's consented to doing a brief introduction for the film, and so they're taping that. The film is in the can, but as soon as they get the Mrs. Reagan taping, they will add it on to the film, and then we will get a copy of the video. And then, of course, we've got tons of videos.
Great.
We could have a video. We could open our own arrows for drug videos.
Now, are these videos that have been prepared by private sector enterprises, local communities, states, whatever?
Mm-hmm.
And the White House or your office has been sent a courtesy copy?
Mm-hmm. Either a courtesy copy, or we've helped them get along and get involved and that sort of thing.
All right, we were just talking about the number of audio tapes
okay.
and what have you that you have, and it sounds like got a gold mine of information for someone interested in getting an idea of what was being done in this country at this point in time on drug abuse.
And we do. And one of the things that we're starting that, and I'm really sorry I'm going to miss, is we're having a meeting in the end of June with all of the federal departments and agencies that are involved in drug abuse education and prevention. by themselves or in conjunction with the private sector. And we're putting together a list of all of the corporations, specific groups, drug-wise or otherwise, think tanks, whatever, that we've worked with and trying to identify, you know, in a huge list form, all the initiatives that have undergone during the Reagan administration. And, you know, just off the, unfortunately, I'm not going to be here to watch it become a document, because most of them I know, at least a smattering of, but we put together a list of something like 45 corporations that have been involved, and that's not the parent groups or the drug-specific groups, the groups that are in existence because of the drug problem, or, you know, celebrities or things like that. They've just been a tremendous support. You know, 5 years ago there was nothing in the private sector, and one of the things that that the president's federalism has worked out real well is the drug issue, because the private sector, as they became, whether they be parents or corporations, as they became more and more aware of the drug problem, they wanted to help. They can't help with law enforcement, and they can't help with the diplomatic initiatives. Where they can help is education, and they've just been remarkable. You know, the Entertainment Industries Council, for example, was started to bring together drug-free celebrities, producers, writers, directors, to try and, one, use their stars to go out and talk to people and say not all of Hollywood does drugs, but two, to try and put pressure on Jack Valente and others to quit writing in trivial drug scenes. You know, marijuana use particularly, or alcohol for that matter, is used as a non-contributing filler in tons of movies. It neither adds nor subtracts to the movie, and if you're very adamant against drugs, it does take away from it. So one of the things that we've been working on is trying to get the rating board to rate movies that glamorize drugs. Or if they show drug use, we're not saying don't show do drugs, show drugs in the movie. But if you do, show them in a realistic manner. You know, don't have some kid shoot up heroin or snort cocaine and not have any bad side effects, because that's not real life. They're going to have bad side effects. And so they were very much against it. The ratings board was very, very much against it. Felt it was censorship. It was putting too much of a burden on the rating system, which is already very fragile and somewhat effective, somewhat not. So Parade magazine did this huge long article. Mike Satchel wrote it. And in the middle, this is wonderful. This kind of reflects how far we've come in 5 years. In the middle of Parade magazine, in the middle of the page, they had this little box that said, "Let us know how you feel." They did this article, "Does Hollywood glamorize drugs or push drugs to kids or whatever?" And they asked if you wanted these movies that glamorize drugs, like Cheech and Chong, or, you know, 9 to 5 for that matter, they all sat around getting high, and it didn't help in a movie, or Private Benjamin. So they said, "Do you want these movies ignored? Do you want them given an SA for substance abuse rating so that you'll know it's there, or you want them rated X just because it's offensive?" So there was something like 19,000 people responded. 19,000 people. They had to go to the center of this page and cut this little box out. It wasn't even perforated, and it was in the dead center of the page. Then they had to write it. Then they had to put it in an envelope. They had to stamp it. They had to address it, and they had to mail it. Well, anybody who's worked with surveys knows that is the worst possible way to get any kind of response. 90% wanted some sort of rating, you know, whether it was X or SA. the fact that that many people responded and the fact that 90% wanted some kind of rating really reflects people's attitudes have changed. It's been very encouraging because, you know, that people are more concerned about their health and their well-being, and they're no longer sitting back and saying, oh, it's not my problem, it's not my responsibility. It is their problem, it is their responsibility, and they're all wakening up to it. So it's been very special.
What sort of liaison work did you do with the Parade magazine people in preparing this article? Were you aware that it was being done?
Mm-hmm. We were aware that it was being done. Ray Nelson, our communications person, was in touch with Mike Satchel beforehand, and we sat down and talked to him, let him know basically how we felt. We didn't want to come out, you know, President and Mrs. Reagan have very close ties to the entertainment industry. We didn't want to come out and feel like we were bullying the ratings board, so we tried to play very low-key. So Mike wrote the article, but he wrote it after having talked with us and with the entertainment industry and trying to reach Jack Valente. Then Senator Roth held some hearings on it on the Hill about a month or so after the article appeared, and Mike Satchel was there, and we had some more discussions. I was up at the hearings. I didn't testify, but I was up at the hearings. We had some more discussions, so he did a follow-up article, which was very good, to show those results of the survey.
Your contacts with the private sector, were these contacts in a face-to-face type situation, over the phone, by letter? Did you go out and visit with them? Did you make speeches to their groups?
I didn't make speeches. I do most of my business on the phone. Or if people come into Washington, they'll come by here, meet with Dr. Turner, and I'll sit in. Or if Dr. Turner's not here, I'll meet with them. The same is true with international visitors. The phone, I think, is permanently attached to my ear. I really do spend an extraordinary amount of time on the telephone. It's really fits. But most of the work is done by phone because, you know, it's not practical to travel around and seek out things. Just because you could be running around like crazy. Dr. Turner does an awful lot of traveling and public speaking. And in the last year, I've given 3 speeches, but they were more on the international side than on the private sector.
So you didn't do much travel?
No, I traveled twice, once to Switzerland and once to Panama, both for State Department-sponsored regional narcotics conferences. And I gave, well, I'm going to New York today, but that doesn't count. Both to give the administration's policy on drug abuse, on the whole issue of drug abuse.
How about your contacts with other departments and agencies? So were there some agencies that you were on almost daily contact with and mm-hmm. others that you probably had rare contact with?
Mm-hmm. I would say of anybody, I was in daily contact with the State Department, particularly the Bureau of International Narcotics Matters. Somebody in that office I probably talked to at least every day. The international responsibilities in my job took up probably 60% of my time. The private sector stuff within the last year probably about 20%, and the First Lady about 20%. It all varies, you know. It's special projects come up or specific initiatives. The international or private sector, or First Lady for that matter, could take up 100% of my time if I'm working on a project. But I work very closely with the State Department, U.S. Information Agency, Agency for International Development, because they're becoming more involved in not just economic development, but educational, drug education programs. They're helping fund programs in regional, in other developing countries. a weekly basis with the intelligence community, all branches of it, whether it be NSA or NSC or DIA or CIA, Naval Intelligence. I did the gambit of going around and meeting with all of their key narcotics people and gotten their briefings, that kinds of things. They come in here to see me and we'll talk, and I'll go out and see them and talk.
In the course of your contacts, would you have done any interviews with people that are, let's say, house organs for various private sector groups or corporations that would come in and want to interview you or members of the staff? So would your name appear in print very much?
No, that's not my, no. My name appeared in print once, and that was it. And that was actually when Gail left, because the alcohol community thought there was a big hoopla that Gail was getting forced out, which wasn't. She was going back to run for Congress. But, you know, we weren't able to say she was going back to run for Congress until she announced. And the alcohol field is so sensitive. I mean, they really are. They've been fighting an uphill battle for so long, and drugs have kind of been secondary. And now all of a sudden drugs have, drug abuse as opposed to alcohol abuse, which we don't really make the distinction, has just taken leaps and bounds and is the issue of the day. Well, it's health alcoholism or teenage alcohol abuse, but it hasn't, they're still very, very protective of their issue. They don't want to get drawn in by those drug people, and, you know, it's terrible. So that's the only time my name ever appeared in print.
The Gail you're referring to is Gail Healy, H-E-A-L-Y. Did you write any articles that appeared in newspapers or magazines or periodicals or whatever?
Under Carlton Turner's name. There's only one star in the Drug Abuse Policy Office, and that's our boss, Carlton Turner. And none of us, we are all good background people, and that's exactly the way we like it. And Carlton's out front, as it should be. He's the one that should take all the responsibility. I mean, he's the one that's got to be up front. Like telephone ringing in your tape?
It's all right. It happens all the time. Well, this leads up to another question. Whoa! Okay, hold on. Following up on that question about writing, how about the documentation of your activities? So will someone coming in years from now to research on drug abuse be able to track you and your responsibilities and your input and your contributions and what have you? Were you a memo writer? Did you write a lot of memos for the record? Did you keep a diary?
The one thing that'll help anybody who wants to research the drug area is we got lax for about a year and a half, but the Drug Abuse Policy Office does weekly reports to our assistant to the president, in this case, Spahn. But we did them for Harper as well. We did not do them during Marty Anderson. And they're very interesting. I'll show you a copy. This is from May to, this is about a year's worth.
Okay, we're looking at a multi-page document.
And we break it down into, it's from Carlton, and it kind of summarizes the staff's activities for the week in question, with projections into the upcoming week. It's relatively informal. They will always be 3 pages long. They never exceed 3 pages. That's our own set rule, but, you know, it's written in first person for Dr. Turner. So, you know, he will say, addressed blah, 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 or Ray, meaning Ray Nelson, met with, or Sharon, meaning Sharon Lumpkins, met with, or Fred Colgan met with, or Dick Williams did this, or, and there's a Sue here somewhere, and there's got to be.
I saw one on the first page.
Yeah, but a lot of mine will almost all end up in here.
In international.
In the international.
And this is a, this would be as good a weekly diary almost, mm-hmm. Of not only your activities, but of all members of the staff, mm-hmm. and the office overall.
Mm-hmm. They're a wonderful thing. They are a good record. If we forget when we did something, a lot of the way the office is arranged is around personalities and evolution, because the staff has grown. So it's the running joke that Carlton and I remember absolutely everything that we have ever done. And it's never happened that we have both forgotten the same person. If he remembers the first name, I'll remember the last name. Or he'll describe a situation and I'll remember the person. Or I'll describe a situation and he'll remember the person. It's going to be, we work very well together. It's going to be very odd not working for him.
Let me flip this tape real quick. I'm getting down toward the end of the questions.
Okay.
What was a typical day like, Sue, or was there anything like that?
You're absolutely right. There is no such thing as a typical day in the White House.
What time would you try to get to the office?
Oh, this last year I've been a little lax, and I've gotten in between 7:30 and 8 in the morning. Usually I'm here between 7 and 7:30. Would never even consider leaving before 6:30 in the evening. More times it's 7:30. Oftentimes it was 8. But only on 2 or 3 occasions have we ever worked on a weekend. One of the nice things about having a relatively young boss is that he also has 2 small young daughters, and weekends are devoted to them. And because he doesn't work, we don't work, which is fair. So he gets us 12 and 14 hours a day, 5 days a week, and we get our weekends off. Nothing is a typical day. And we will, no matter how hard you try to plan in advance to say, well, we're going to have this project coming up, we're going to have this coming down the road, everything is a crisis. And invariably, they will come at 4 o'clock on a Friday afternoon. And we wanted it yesterday. And the only person you can get the answer from is in New Zealand. You know, it's just like any other office in that regard.
Did you folks have a staff meeting on a weekly basis, a daily basis, a quarterly basis?
We have staff meetings every day.
Particular time during the day?
9:15 every morning. And it'll usually run from 9:15 to 10. That's when Dr. Turner's first meeting will have been.
Okay, so that takes place on a daily basis, mm-hmm. These staff meetings.
And it's a very good management tool that Dr. Turner uses, because the way the office is structured, it really is structured around personality, but we all have different responsibilities, and we know basically what they are. Ray Nelson handles communications and public affairs. Fred Colgan handles law enforcement, drug law enforcement, and our congressional liaison. He used to work on the Hill, which is largely why. Dick Williams handles management, strategy, long-term planning, everything. He's our institutional memory. I have a great deal of respect for Dick. He knows this issue and the budget, any budget, better than anybody I've ever seen. He's terrific. And Sharon does mostly education and prevention. Sharon's recently new to the staff to have a job area, so hers is still evolving. As I said, we had had her on detail twice before. And when DEA wouldn't detail her back, we said, fine, we'll hire her. So we stole her away from civil service system and hired her over here. And Sharon's terrific. She's been with the Drug Enforcement Administration for 14 years and really knows the issue well. And she's a terrific writer and good computer person. So lots of good things. And
Let me follow up with all of that. Do you find that this office more or less kind of goes off independently and does their own thing, or are these projects done as a group project?
Yes and no.
That's what I figured the answer would be.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff is done on an individual basis. You know, for example, I don't need any help talking to the State Department about an OAS report. If it's a special project, one of the unique things about the drug office, which has been made a very special place to work, is that we don't work together just because we work together. We're all very good friends. With spouses, after hours, the staff always does things periodically. Birthday parties, well, all the spouses were at the party last night. My farewell party.
A very nice one, I might add. I was flattered that I was there.
But, you know, we'll go out and get a drink, even if it's a Coke, after work. The office is more a family than it is just a work relationship. And it's a very unusual feeling. It's a very unusual way to run an office. Part of the reason that we get so much done is because we work so closely together all the time.
Knowing that your time is very precious, Sue, let me jump to really the last two questions. I appreciate the fact that you're doing this on the last day you're here, the morning of that you're leaving. Was there any one event or any activity or project that stands out head and shoulders above all the rest that you'll always point to when someone says, what's your favorite memory of your White House years?
There's a lot of them. But the one in particular is an easy answer. In September 1984, the President and Mrs. Reagan gave certificates of appreciation to three individuals and three corporations for their exemplary service to the nation in fighting drug abuse. The drug office designed the certificates. It was our idea. Dr. Turner pushed the scheduling proposal through and got everyone to agree to the certificates, and was project officer for the event, or signed project officer. Jack Svahn was really the project officer. By virtue of the fact that Dr. Turner was project officer, Sue did all the work. And so I wrote the justifications for the six recipients, basically had a free hand in selecting them. We had a reception in the state dining room with punch and cookies and coffee. Combined it with a signing ceremony with the President for National Drug Abuse Education and Prevention Week. Full press coverage, over 250 guests, some members of Congress.
Do you remember the names of these honorees?
The three corporations were the Keeper Company, and that was before they had done their I Believe in Me film. DC Comics is the one who, largely because they did the comic books, they donated the art and the talent. And McNeil Pharmaceutical. McNeil Pharmaceutical, which is a division of Johnson & Johnson, developed the Pharmacist Against Drug Abuse program. Pharmacist Against Drug Abuse. Yeah, that's it. PADA. I'm not used to speaking out my acronyms. And they've distributed it nationally to all the pharmacies around the nation to have available to clients. The three individuals were Ross Perot. He started Texans War on Drugs. Marcia Manette, M-A-N-A-T-T. She goes by Keith, however.
By what?
Keith.
Keith? K-E-I-T-H?
Keith.
Sure glad you told me that.
And her last name is Shuchard. S-C-H-U-C-H-A-R-D. Shuchard is how it looks like it should be spelled, but A-R-D.
A-R-D, no T at the end.
No D at the
Now, this is Marcia?
Marcia Manette Shuhart is her real name, but Keith Shuhart is how everybody knows her. And I can't remember her real first name, but Sis, S-I-S, is her nickname, Wenger, W-E-N-G-E-R, from Birmingham, Michigan. She, Keith Shuhart was responsible for writing a lot of publications that the National Institute on Drug Abuse has now picked up, for starting the Parent Resource Institute for Drug Education down in Atlanta. Mrs. Reagan's visited them every year. And she's been a stalwart in the drug fight for years and years. Sis Wenger is the epitome of volunteerism. She hasn't written any books, but through her junior league, she started a curriculum, sort of, to get communities and schools involved in drug abuse. And she worked in Birmingham, Michigan, until it was expanded to Detroit and throughout the state, and now it was being picked up by junior leagues all over the nation.
When someone wants to talk to you more about this office and about your contributions to it, let's say 15 years from now, Sue, how would they track you down? That's the one question always throws everybody. Let me give you some helps. Are there organizations that you will be a member of, you think, in the future that will be able to provide an address for you?
Well, the Indiana Society, probably.
Now, that's a state society?
Mm-hmm, in Washington.
In Washington.
Mm-hmm. It's relatively new. Hoosiers are a little slow in getting started.
How about the Republican National Committee? You've been in politics up to this point.
Yeah, they might know where we are. I guess I'm certainly articulate. If Senator Quayle's in office, they'll know where I am.
College or university?
They'll probably know where I am. Indiana State University in Terre Haute, Indiana is my alma mater. And Webster was not a close friend of mine. For obvious reasons, I mutilate his language.
You're leaving soon to go over to Vienna. Would you just briefly say what you're going to be doing over there?
Okay. The U.S. government will pay for my salary, but I will in turn be assigned to the United Nations, to the Secretary General for the World Conference. The UN is sponsoring a world conference in June of 1987 on drug abuse and illicit trafficking. And they have asked for the governments of Germany, France, and the United States to donate a person to help them put the conference together. Germany has already identified someone, and he will be handling largely law enforcement issues for the conference agenda, negotiating with other agencies and that sort of thing. I've been identified as the U.S. person, and I will be doing public affairs, and education prevention, drug awareness activities, those kinds of things, just like I do here. And the French have not identified their person yet, but they will be doing mostly the medical treatment, detoxification, research, those kinds of pharmacy issues. And as I said, the conference will be in June of 87, and then there'll be some follow-up involved. The three of us, along with the Secretary General's staff, will be responsible for preparing briefing papers and concept papers, developing the agenda and the background papers, getting and giving information to foreign governments, and in my case, to, in UN language, non-governmental organizations. Private sector has a whole different meaning in a lot of European countries, so I have to get used to non-governmental organizations. And bringing all this together, working, in my case again, doing some public affairs for the conference, world advertising, just to let them know the UN is caring and doing something.
And that will last for what, a year and a half or so?
It'll last for about a year and a half. After the conference, we will be responsible for doing the follow-up reports. One of the goals that we want is to heighten awareness worldwide of the dangers of drugs, to let them know the impact that the drug trade has on economies, both in producing, transit, and consumer nations, and to get the world to respond with action and make it more difficult for traffickers and producers.
Sounds like an exciting but very full agenda and schedule. But based on what you told me, it sounds like it's just going to be another day at the office for you, just a different location.
Except the UN works terribly long hours, like 9 to 4.
Oh.
I might have a hard time coping with that.
Sue, I know you've got to run. I'll sign off, and thank you very much for this.